From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 1965, Twyla Tharp presented Tank Dive, a seven-minute dance piece at Hunter College in New York City. Few critics attended Tank Dive in New York or in its London premiere, but Tharp's choreography broke new ground, deconstructing a classic art form with a gutsy and clever vision. 125 dances, 5 films, 2 Emmy Awards, and a Tony Award later, Twyla Tharp continues to create. In collaborations with diverse artists from Milos Forman to Mikhail Baryshnikov to Billy Joel, she's learned the value of discipline when calling the muse. In a new book, Twyla Tharp rejects the romantic vision of the heaven-inspired artist, looking instead to the power of rituals of creation and old-fashioned elbow grease. Tonight on Point, diving into the creative habit with a woman who knows a thing or two about it, Twyla Tharp. Joining me now from New York is Twyla Tharp, dancer, choreographer, director, and author of The Creative Habit. Twyla Tharp, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much, Tom. It's a pleasure.
It's great to have you. We want to have a little workshop with you tonight. We know from something you told the Time Out in New York that you wrote this book because you needed some scratch. You needed some cash to put together your production with Billy Joel. We don't care why you wrote it. You're so creative. We want to know how you do it. And I wanted to jump in asking you, in the background here, we're listening to some Mozart, Dove Sono from The Marriage of Figaro, sung here by Kiri Takanawa. You were involved with Milos Forman in Amadeus, and I was fascinated to read in your book that the portrayal of creativity that comes across in that film is almost absolutely the opposite of your view of how it happens. Can you tell us that story?
The movie of Amadeus and the play were designed to be theatrical ventures, so there was much drama. In fact, Mozart, who's become one of my best friends because I've read his letters, listened to much of his music, and thought quite a lot about him, is given often the appearance of being genius born, and that his inspiration flowed, there was no problem, and everything just came from the gods. This is because he had range that was unbelievable, and because, for example, his orchestral scores are absolutely clean. For the most part, he wrote vertically rather than horizontally.
Meaning standing up?
Yeah, right. Meaning in all kinds of positions, actually, given Mozart, but no, meaning that he wrote the staff from the top, the high voices down to the bass line, rather than writing across, which is extremely unusual. And it means that he had it whole cloth in his head when he set out to write it down. So we think that this guy is just like way out there genetically, and that's the end of the story. This is all not true.
And, of course, that's the conceit of the movie. You've got Antonio Salieri being so jealous. Why did God touch this man? Why did he set him on fire and not me?
Yeah, and the answer is because Amadeus was born to Leopold. Leopold Mozart, his father, saw to it that by the time Mozart was 10 years old, he had been exposed to every composer doing anything of worth in Europe, and that the kid was ready to write an opera and move on from there. Mozart did so much work that by the time he was in his early 30s, his writing hand was deformed. And it's not easy to become Mozart. It's not easy to remain Mozart. And we mustn't be romantic about this. On the other hand, we also need to acknowledge that everybody is gifted. Mozart was gifted musically. Others are gifted visually. And the business here is to find the talent, however large or however small, be grateful for it and protect it, encourage it, nurture it, develop it, challenge it.
Here's the theme of the entire book, your new book, The Creative Habit, is how to dig in and cultivate and run with the creativity, the talent that you've got, and not wait for God just to drop it down from on high. Twyla Tharp, you've done so much with dance and choreography over the years, and of course there's something ultimately creative about that. I mean, you have to fill up that room just with human motion and turn it into something. I wish you'd read for us just a bit from the top of your book about that experience, the experience of a choreographer just about as big and great as they come in our lifetimes, in you walking into that room.
Yes, I'm happy to read the opening of the book for you, to you, with you. But remember that this book, while it does begin by introducing me as a person who's had some of this experience, this book is not about me, ultimately. It is for the reader. But I do have to kind of suggest I've got some chops here, so this is how we begin. I walk into a large white room. It's a dance studio in Midtown Manhattan. I'm wearing a sweatshirt, faded jeans, and Nike Cross trainers. The room is lined with 8-foot-high mirrors. There's a boombox in the corner. The floor is clean, virtually spotless, if you don't count the thousands of skid marks and footprints left there by dancers rehearsing. Other than the mirrors, the boombox, the skid marks, and me, the room is empty. To some people, this empty room symbolizes something profound, mysterious, and terrifying. The task of starting with nothing and working your way toward creating something whole and beautiful and satisfying. It's no different for a writer rolling a fresh sheet of paper into his typewriter, or more likely firing up the blank screen on his computer, or a painter confronting a Virgil canvas, a sculptor staring at a raw chunk of stone, a composer at the piano with his fingers hovering just above the keys. Some people find this moment, the moment before creativity begins, so painful that they simply cannot deal with it. To get up, they walk away from the computer, the canvas, the keyboard. They take a nap or go shopping or fix lunch or do chores around the house. They procrastinate. In its most extreme form, this terror totally paralyzes people. The blank space can be humbling, but I faced it my whole professional life. It's my job. It's also my calling. Bottom line, filling this empty space constitutes my identity.
Twyla Tharp, reading from her new book, The Creative Habit. She's been creative over an enormous career in dance, on stage, in film, famously recently on Broadway, where you put together a show with Billy Joel out of his music. But as you say, you're not writing here just for choreographers, not even just for artists. You're saying there are habits of creativity that can stretch right across any field of endeavor, really.
Absolutely. And so I find this kind of communication between some of the lessons I've learned and moving them over to other folks very rewarding. There is a publicist who came to me and said, look, you really nailed it. I'm back to my exercise routine. I've been out of it, but I can see that if I don't, I'm shortchanging myself. There's a psychiatrist who bought 4 of these and leaves the creative habits stashed around in the waiting room so that when his clients arrive, they'll find one and perhaps read about the fear chapter before they move into his room to start solving problems. I find this all very gratifying.
That people care, that people want to know, that people want to be creative.
No, that people can use. That people can use what I have found to be a way of working, that I can share this.
We're going to learn more about you tonight, but we really want, at the heart of this, a workshop on creativity. You've proven your chops. We want to help other people to do the same. You've got a terrific body of exercises in the book, and I'd just like to jump straight into those. You start off with a question. You say, where is your pencil? It sounds like one of these business management, hokey come-on lines, but you say you've got to come with the stuff.
Yes, there's a small story, a little anecdote in this first exercise. A boy goes out of the house wanting Willie Mays' autograph. He gets there. He has a baseball. He finds Willie Mays. Willie Mays says, kid, I'd love to give you an autograph. Give me your pencil. Kid goes, no pencil. And looks around. Nobody has a pencil. He does not get Willie Mays' autograph. How simple is that? You got to go out every day being prepared to confront a little bit of magic, and when it comes, you got to be ready for it.
Meaning, be prepared in terms of
do what you can. At least put your pencil in your pocket, whatever the equivalent of the pencil is for, you know, the reader, whether it's a camera, whether it's a mind that's looking for an adjective, an adverb, something that strikes a chord. A businessman going, oh, I got this horrible problem. Is this deal going to fall through? And suddenly sees something happen, an interaction, and goes, oh, yeah, right. I remember. I can make that work.
So at the very simplest level, here's someone in yourself who's spent a lifetime in creative pursuit saying, just come ready to do it. Don't expect it to sort of come to you full blown, to come up out of nowhere.
Exactly. Expect that you're going to run into it. Don't wait for it to come. Be proactive with the looking for inventiveness.
Do you remember when you were first getting into dance and choreography in the 60s, you spent a number of years working it hard without a lot of, I mean, there was success, but you were on a shoestring for, I don't know, what, 3, 4, 5 years in the mid-60s. Did you feel like you had brought what you needed in those years?
In those 5 years, I was just busily asking questions. And you know what? I didn't expect a whole lot from success. Recently, I was giving a lecture, and someone in the audience said, well, what do you do about if you kind of try? You know, you're the guy on the street. You try for a couple of years. Nothing is happening. Do you quit? And I said, well, look, in the beginning, I took very little as a registration for success. In other words, in my very first concert, you know, 3 people came and 1 stayed. I was encouraged. It could have been everybody walked out, but 1 stayed. You have to be, again, the same thing, proactive.
Now, here's one that I found interesting in a choreographer who, by definition, has to work with dancers. You say, sort of exercise number 2, build up your tolerance for solitude. Coming from you, Twyla Tharp, that surprises me a little. What do you mean?
Yes, because choreography is much in collaboration. But in this book, I emphasize the need for self-reliance, that ultimately one needs independence as a thinker of any sort, and that to know your own mind, you have to be prepared to sit alone and perhaps silently with nothing coming in by way of distraction or input, and ponder what is it that I need to get done here, and decide that by yourself, for yourself.
For most,
you need, before you can guide others, you got to have some idea where you're going.
For most people, that in itself is difficult, yet you're saying it's the only way to sort of listen to yourself and figure out what you're up to, what you're about. But I guess the question is, for people who have a hard time even getting over that hurdle, how important is creativity for, you know, what portion of people need real creativity? Are you saying everybody in every job needs this?
Yes, I'm saying we can look at this title 2 ways. The creative habit, that is to say, the workforces required for a person to be creative in the sort of conventional sense, musically, as a painter, as a writer, even as a chef. It's got to be habitual. It's got to be practiced on a regular basis. Now, you can flip this title, so it's not just the creative habit, but it's habits looked at creatively. I was actually in Philadelphia this morning, and I was doing a television program, and the cameraman, Charlie, came up to me and said, you know, I decided to turn it around here for you because I wanted this other background. And I said, Charlie, that's fabulous. Thank you so much, because doesn't that feel better than just using the same old staid background? He said, yeah, it feels fresh. So he's habitually going to be shooting this show, but he decided he'd try something different. So making one's habits creative, it keeps things churning. This is good.
We're gonna keep going with the workshop on creativity with Twyla Tharp, but we want to learn about you as you've done it. I mean, you were able to just call up Billy Joel and say, hey, Billy, let's do a show, and off you went. And you had a huge success on Broadway, back up in the big lights on Broadway with dance recently. Not everybody can do that. Does it require that kind of conduit to other creative people to make big things happen?
I think it requires a certain amount of chutzpah, for starters, and it doesn't hurt to have a track record. It depends on look, be realistic, okay? Go for what is within your reach. I didn't call up Billy Joel 20 years ago and say, hey, come over here, I got something I want to do, because I, A, didn't know how to do it 20 years ago, and B, I couldn't have made it work 20 years ago. So set yourself goals that are within your ken.
Why Billy Joel? You worked with the Beach Boys years ago. Why Billy Joel this time?
Actually, it was my son, Jesse, who said, hey, Mom, let's do rock and roll. And I said, okay, who? He says, Billy Joel. I said, okay, I can get with that program, because I'd been listening to Billy's music for a very, very long time in the studio. I thought that as I was thinking again about it, yeah, Billy is he's a miniaturist. He's a great short story writer. He makes really good characters in his songs. And I thought I began to see an epic that I could evolve from these, as I call them, shards. shards that I could create the whole piece of pottery.
We're talking tonight with dancer and choreographer Twyla Tharp about the process of creativity, about what it takes to be creative. We'll go out here listening to She's Got Away from the original broadcast recording of Moving Out, her Tony Award-winning Broadway hit with a storyline and dance inspired by Billy Joel's music. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
She comes to me when I'm feeling down, inspires me without a sound. She touches me and I gotta turn around.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with the great dancer and choreographer, Twyla Tharp, about creativity. She's got a new book out called The Creative Habit. It lays down the exercises that she's found useful in her extremely creative life. They may be useful for you, too, whether you're in the arts, whether you're in business, whether you're at home making a home happen. Creativity kind of pulls it all together. Twyla Tharp is good enough to be with us tonight to share the exercises that have made her creative. She thinks it can work for you as well. Behind us right here, music from The Catherine Wheel, 1999, directed and choreographed by Twyla Tharp, with music produced, composed, and performed by David Byrne, Talking Heads. Twyla Tharp, you really do reach out to all kinds of people to make this happen. It's not just Mozart and the classics or just modern music. You've done plenty with pop as well.
Right. I think that art is about reaching as many people as possible. I don't see it as elitist, though I certainly see it as highly challenging and capable of absorbing all of one's skill.
The Village Voice said of this production, "You won't ever have seen people so beautiful, so brave, so engaged with the moment as the dancers that you had out there." How do you stir up the creativity in the people you're working with?
By asking for a little bit more than they might think they had, but suspecting that they do. I think that it's always my privilege to have enormous talent to go with, and it's a venture for all of us to sort of crash through the barricades that we know we can do and then see, okay, where else can we go here? To invent a new lift or find a new way of moving or something rhythmically, it makes you smile.
The BBC did a piece on the Catherine Wheel and talked with one of your dancers about her transformation for the part she played there. Let's listen for a moment.
It was difficult in the sense that I had to get over being terribly self-conscious of being really ugly and deep down inside enjoying it, but sort of being affected by how other people felt watching it and other people's comments. So it got harder to do, actually, because so many people had so much to say about it. Either they didn't want to see me be ugly, or they were repulsed by it, or they really liked it. It was very difficult. I mean, making faces and holding them and putting that kind of tension in your body is unlike what you try. It's sort of opposite of what you do as a dancer, trying to release that kind of tension. So to really pull something out to the last, that was very different.
A Twyla Tharp dancer from the 1999 The Catherine Wheel talking there about what you put her through for a particular kind of creativity. She had to be not beautiful for the role, for the dance, as you conceived it. She had to be ugly. For her, that was hard. Facing fears, she was afraid of that. Facing fears is another part of reaching out for creativity, as you describe it.
Right. We begin, actually, the second chapter as a confrontation with the fears that we all have. We aren't good enough. We aren't pretty enough. People will laugh at us. We are being overly ambitious, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All of these devices we use to sort of stalemate ourselves. So as a director, when I can say to somebody, hey, you know, this may not be the prettiest you've ever been. Actually, they wish to do this and they want to try being different. So if they get the slightest bit of encouragement, they'll go for it. And the trick here is to give that encouragement to yourself so that you will also go for that which might be conventionally, quote, ugly, end quote, but actually is something challenging and different to try. And you find beauty in all kinds of places. It's the word itself gains a different feeling.
Twyla Tharp, I wonder about the fears that you came with to your career, about the fears that you still have. You were born in Portland, Indiana, moved to Southern California early on. Your mother had you in every kind of arts involvement under the sun, every kind of dance and drum and baton and violin and viola and French and
Don't forget the shorthand in case I failed at absolutely everything.
Also, there was a backup plan. We've got to talk about risk in all this. And then I love this story. You were at Pomona College, but if they've got this right, that you were nearly expelled there from making out with your boyfriend
in the college chapel. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Maybe that's a little prod to be creative. You had to kind of make things happen all over again, move to Barnard College in New York. But what about your fears coming out of that very disciplined childhood of the arts and right on into your adult career? What fears still stay with you when you sit down or see that blank room in front of you?
I had two choices. I could either go, whoops, there's something terribly the matter with me. My mother is just trying every which thing to repair me, whether it was my ear training or teaching me to bow a violin or dancing. Maybe I didn't walk good enough. And I think that this intensive childhood also caused me to be obviously somewhat reclusive since I had to practice all of these things. I could have looked at it as though it were a burden. And like I was just never going to crawl out from underneath it. On the other hand, I could look at it as an extraordinary education that offered me all sorts of information, all of which has in one way or another, even including the shorthand, come in for some good usage.
You mentioned there the solitude that your childhood of lessons and practice imposed on you. But this gets back to some of your advice about creativity. You say part of it is to strip away other things. You say, try 1 week without. What do you mean by that?
See what you can eliminate. I, for example, do not have a television set. I do have monitors for video, but I never watch television because I read a great deal. And I, if I'm thinking we'll take away even my reading, I'll take away the New York Times. I don't need input on occasion. In fact, I need no input on occasion. I'll limit what I'm eating. I will monitor that which is coming in because I'm trying to expand from the inside out, and I don't want a lot of stuff going on. That's not always the case, but there are times when I find that kind of isolation to be helpful in clearing the head and getting to what I'm really trying to say here.
For a lot of people these days, a life full of stuff, all the way down to that terrible word, but everybody knows what it means, multitasking, is just a way of life. You're saying clear that away to make space for something really new, something really different.
Sometimes I'm a great multitasker. Look, I can love to juggle four or five things at one time. It's a challenge. And I think that's kind of fun. That's the fast lane. But I'm not convinced that's actually where you get work done. It's a kind of coordination, which is valuable. But the business of self-reliance is that it is you. It is not you plus input. It's you. And what there do you understand?
Now, here's an interesting one coming from you, Twyla Tharp, a unique name. You say pick a new name. I don't know how that works for a businessman or for someone who's searching for creativity when they've already established a name. But A, where did your family come up with Twyla if they did? And B, are you really suggesting that other people go out and pick a new name for themselves?
Let me deal with the second part first. No. If someone... There are Oriental traditions where young people strive and become themselves at a certain point in their career. It is then that they can select the name that they will have as an artist. Kabuki artists, for example, begin as young people in the theater, and they mature into names that have great lineage and tradition to them. Mozart loved to change his name. There are 14 different versions of names for Mozart until he finally just gave up and settled on the one. And he always did it because he was trying on new identities. When he finally just went, okay, look, I don't have time for this name thing anymore. I'm writing music. Then he kept Amadeus. But it took him a little time to get there. At one point, he called himself Adam. So it's not unuseful. There are people, Cassius Clay, for one, found a whole new identity and gave himself a whole new name. Not a lot of people, obviously, are going to go into that extreme a sphere. But it should always be a massively challenging possibility. For myself, my mother found the name Twyla in a local paper in the Midwest. And that Twyla, spelled with an I, was the princess of the local hog calling contest. My mother clipped it and looked at this name and said, I think I'll change the I to a Y because it will look better on a marquee. Okay?
Wow, your mom had plans for you.
She had plans, and I had to grow into that name, so there would be no need for me to change it. It was designed to do what it does.
And you're not saying everybody then needs to change the name from Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali, but in the exercise of imagining what that name would be, you can try on this persona, that persona.
Exactly. And see how it feels. Does it feel right? As I said, that's what Mozart did. He did it as a game. But the business of naming is very powerful.
Bottom line, you don't believe in, and we talked about it earlier, in inspiration just being handed down out of the clouds. But you're very...
Oh, I do, only you got to be ready for it. Well, I do actually think chance plays a big part. I think you can be lucky. I do talk about both of these things in the book. Mm-hmm. But you have to be ready. You can't sit around waiting for that to motivate you. You have to be prepared, and then you can use it. You can go with it. You can drop what you came in the door with because you see something better in front of your eyes. But you know what? If you don't, you at least got something to get you through the day.
Well, I wanted to get through via that this idea of the muse that inspires people to think in new ways, to act in new ways, to conceive in new ways. I think many people imagine the muse as an inspiration that walks in and whispers in their ear, and voila, you've got the creative product. You see it differently.
Yes, well, let's just go with the idea of this muse. The muses are all the children of Jupiter in junction with Mnemosyne, the root of memory, was the woman who bore all of the muses. There is no art without memory. There is no art without metaphor. There is no creativity without a background. And contrary to some popular mythology, you will not lose your originality by knowing something.
So you're saying choose a particular muse, be inspired by a particular character?
Well, in the book, there is a series of questions which allow one, hopefully, to get, if you don't already know, that you're more interested in writing, say, language than you are in throwing pots, that will help young people, I suspect, in particular, I hope, to realize that the gift is more in this direction than in another. So find first that and then, feed it, develop it. And you may change around 10 times. There's nothing the matter with that. I mean, I've learned a great deal. In fact, I use in the book this word transactional a lot. It's one of my favorite concepts, which you learn something in one place and you just move it over into another arena. I've learned as much about choreography from music or from painting or from literature as I have actually from moving.
You mentioned reading as one of your habits earlier, but you describe your reading as maybe not everybody's way of reading. You read in a very kind of aggressive, opportunistic fashion, as you describe.
Yes,
it.
I do. Opportunistic is exactly right. I encourage the person who is the art patron, viewer, whatever, to ask one question. What's in it for me? What can I use? What do I understand here? So when I read, it is about what makes sense to me and what prods me to think in a slightly different way. How can I use this?
Not everybody comes at life with that kind of opportunistic grabbing of inspiration here and there that they want to turn into their own product. Are you suggesting
they could
be creative, or you're not alive, or is this for a select few? Is this for everybody?
No, I think it's for absolutely everybody. Why sit and passively expect to be entertained by anything? How much better to look at it actively and say, "Oh yeah, that makes real sense to me. That is a good idea."
When
right?
Of course, I can see that, and yet we know the Couch Potato Nation is out there, and it's easy to slide into it, and many of us can become a part of it for different times. When you look, I'm just curious, Twyla Tharp, when you look at a room of people, maybe dancers, maybe not even dancers,
After a career paying close attention to all this, can you see who's switched on with creativity and who's not?
That's a really fun, interesting question. My little company, my repertory company, was also traveling this year, and I hate parties, okay, but every now and again I get sort of rooked in professionally to going to a gala event or something. Sure. I was at a party, and I saw a guy there in Houston, Texas, who looked really interesting, kind of. And I went over and started talking to him. Well, he turns out to be a philosopher who is head of the department there. And I'm very interested in philosophy. I'm not educated, but I'm interested. So I actually got him to refer me to a couple of books. Well, I've started a correspondence with Brett O. Johnson, and he's become one of my very best friends. Just from seeing him, he was interesting to talk to for 2 seconds. Now I have not only a friend, but a guy who's feeding me information from, you know, Socrates through to Goodman. This is fabulous. Recently, I had the good fortune to be introduced to a gentleman who turns out to be the guy who figured out what the gases at the Delphi Oracle are. How cool is that?
Gases are? I don't even know what you mean by that.
Oh, well, the Delphic Oracle, right, in Greece.
Yes, sure.
Right. What happened is, in fact, there was a double fault where the temple stood, and that there was a chemical that actually did make the priestesses high. So,
people
that these
had visions because the gas was coming out of the earth.
Right. And so, you know, a guy who is a thinking person in the same room as you comes up with this reality 2,000 years after the fact.
And
this is fabulous.
Suddenly things are pinging. It gets you pinging as well.
Absolutely. Isn't this great?
You worked a lot with Milos Forman over your career in Ragtime, in Hair, in Amadeus. What was he like to work with?
Milos is – could you be a little more specific?
He has a technique with actors where he keeps them very much on edge. And I wonder if that produces creativity, being kind of off-kilter, out of your element.
What it does, I think, is produces his movie, because Milos is great at the beginning and the end of the process. He's a great editor, and he is terrific with casting. So he casts exactly what he wants a person to be, and he wants them not to change between the time he casts them and he gets them in front of the camera. He doesn't want them rehearsing. He doesn't want them developing. He doesn't want them becoming anything other than what he knows them to be. So he doesn't give them the script until it's time to basically roll the cameras. And this clearly could be frustrating to a lot of actors. I mean, it's contrary to the way and to the challenge for many people to develop a role. But that's who Milos is, and that's how he sees it.
And maybe impossible with dancers. I mean, you have to talk about what you want them to do.
You never tell them what you want them to do. You never use language because that would be to shortchange the process. You need to see if what you have in your head is visually going to make sense, because it's a visual art form. It doesn't matter what I might say I'm doing in language. If it doesn't come across the footlights visually, it doesn't matter what I'm calling it.
So you're communicating physically with them then?
Right.
And why not? It's dance. We're talking tonight with Twyla Tharp about the creative habit. She says it's not just for dancers or choreographers, even for artists. It can work in every life, and we know that's true. We're going into a kind of workshop with her. Here's some music from Hair, 1979, directed by Milos Forman. Twyla Tharp was there with the choreography. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
When the moon is in the seventh house and Jupiter aligns with Mars, then peace will guide the planets and love will steer the stars. This is the dawning of the age of Aquarius, the age of Aquarius, Aquarius, Aquarius.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with the great choreographer and dancer, Twyla Tharp, about creativity at the heart of any artist's life, and she recommends at the heart of any life. She's out with a new book describing how to grab onto it. It's called The Creative Habit, and she says it's not just waiting for it to pour down from the heavens. Music behind us from Ragtime, 1981, directed by Milos Forman again and choreographed again by Twyla Tharp. It's only one of scores and scores of bits and major pieces of choreography she's done over an incredibly celebrated career. It sounds so sweet, Twyla Tharp, but one of your exercises in pursuing creativity, one of your pieces of advice is pick a fight. You say creativity is an act of defiance.
Let me connect that to this particular piece of music, which was written by Randy Newman, who did the score, referring every now and again to authentic ragtime music. But anyway, Randy Newman hates writing music. He does it extremely well, but he hates doing it. So at one point in his life, he decided he'd become a concert artist and started taking classical piano lessons. He had to practice so many hours a day, didn't have time for composition. This is the degree to which paranoia, fear, insecurity can push. And sometimes a way of breaking that mold is just to get really pissed and just go for it with this kind of blind energy. Where I learned that lesson is in the gym. I do weight training, and I've done powerlifting. Yes, hello, I have lifted 225 pounds from the ground up to my waist, not over my head, but that counts.
That's great.
And there's a point where you rip a weight that you really can't quite handle out of the ground, and you have to get so pissed to do it, you think about nothing but that energy surge, and sometimes that's what it takes, if that's what it takes.
Just rip-snorting magic to break through, to make it happen.
Yeah, not all the time, but it's just one of the resources. It's just one of the skills. There's another exercise in the book that's called, for example, take away a skill. Many fighters, sword fighters, for example, there's a 15th century well-known book called The Five Rings. And if you're a master swordsman, you don't keep going with the same moves. You mix it around a lot, and you don't even use the same sword, because if you do, your opponent, or in a basketball game, or in a football game, your strategies become known, and you're defeatable once that happens. So you know what? Take away that favorite skill and see what you can put in its place instead for a backup system that will throw off the opponent.
Figure out how to work without it. At the other end of kind of the emotional coloring here, you describe how good luck, fortune, is important to anyone who's trying to be creative. But you say the way to sort of open the door to luck is to be generous. Speak to that, Twyla Tharp.
Right. I think that those who seek to hold very close to the chest close a lot of doors. And if you are fortunate enough to work with a lot of talent and you're very open with people and you essentially give them everything you got. When I work with a great dancer, I'm giving them everything I've got because I want them to be able to utilize that talent to the max. And they're going to give me everything they've got in return. And between us, we will have better good fortune than if each of us is slunking in a corner being very defensive or insecure and just trying to present that which we think is our best foot or face forward.
So be generous and you're more open to the good fortune for you, for everybody collaborating with you.
Right. You allow for change to come in. You're not just protecting the status quo, which is the death of anybody who's trying to think in a new way.
You write about the difference between, if I've got these Greek words correct, zoe and bios.
Zoe and bios are both Greek words for life, but life of a very different sort. Bio is the basis of biology. Zoe of zoology. Biology is the notion that there is a beginning, a middle, and an end, that there is detail, that there is story. Zoology is the notion that there is just a life force. Not just, but that is the quality going. And I cite two choreographers here, both of whom I knew and both of whom were important to me, Balanchine as being the zoetropical master and Jerome Robbins as being the guy who could tell a story really, really well and could describe character, because with bio, detail tells all, and with Zoe, large picture tells all. And I do believe that people are essentially genetically inclined towards one viewing or another.
Twyla Tharp, we've just got a couple minutes left. Sit way back with us for a moment. You're looking out at the same world we all are, the same news. We could use some creativity here, couldn't we? Things seem stuck a little bit. Can these things be writ large? Can they become part of a national culture, of a global culture?
Oh, my goodness, you are asking me to get way back, aren't you? I think that there's obviously in those who seek a responsible new path that the key here is responsibility, that we do have to acknowledge about a past, that things like generosity can play in here, and things like an infinitude of solutions, not one way, not my way, not just the way, but that there are many, many ways to get things done, and we need to have respect for numerous ways of accomplishing things.
Do you think it will happen? Is it a catching perspective?
I don't know if it will happen, but I think that if people will take up some of these exercises, for example, chaos and coins, take out of your pocket whatever you've got, throw it on the table, and give yourself 3 minutes to make 40 different arrangements. Go for it.
That sounds like a good idea. I think I could put some global policymakers to work with that and see if we can't come up with something
great.
Don't
you think?
Yes, yes. Let's throw it down and see it a new way. Twyla Tharp, it's just great talking with you. We feel a little bit opportunistic ourselves. We've grabbed everything off you that we can in 1 hour.
And okay, let's go for another hour.
Yeah, we could easily do it.
Thank you. What's
your next project?
Oh, in the book, I speak about how we can't foresee the future. I can't tell you. I know maybe where I will start. I don't know where I will end up, and I can't lie to you, so I can't tell you what I will do. Plus, which, even if I could, you know what? I wouldn't, because talking is not doing.
Okay.
Bad news there.
We've got the lessons. There's the empty white room. Go and fill it beautifully. Twyla Tharp, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Twyla Tharp's new book is The Creative Habit. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
To the charges of murdering one of the sniper shooting victims and of committing an act of terrorism to intimidate the public, Muhammad quietly entered a plea of not guilty.
This spacecraft, developed and built by China, and carrying an astronaut who we have trained ourselves, has been successfully launched into space.
Now, it's quite clear from our discussions that issues around homosexuality will continue to be difficult and divisive for the Anglican Communion, as they are for many Christians.
I do think what binds us together is deeper than some of the things that divide us, and certainly the whole question of human sexuality, more particularly homosexuality, is far from settled.
You just ran for your life. It was like when the iceberg sliced open the Titanic. These were beams slicing over the side of this ferry.
Sancte Bernarde. In my opinion, he also has been a very political pope. And I think that his influence on the world has been tremendous.
Buonamente parlando, non trepidare.
The security personnel who were attacked were part of a convoy of armored vehicles, including American diplomats with official business to conduct in Gaza for the American embassy.
The resolution accomplishes the objectives that the president had when we began to bring the international community together to agree on a plan to move forward to restore full sovereignty of Iraq back to the Iraqi people.
Shortly before 2:40 p.m. local time, a vehicle passing in front of the Turkish embassy exploded, destroying the exterior wall and causing some slight structural damage to the building.
The American public has been incredibly generous. But to have that strings attached is going to send a message that's not going to be positive in getting additional contributions from the donor nation.
It's very hard for me to go home and explain how you have to give $20 billion to a country that's sitting on $1 trillion worth of oil.
Now Urbina's 1-0 pitch to Bacco. Here it comes, and it's lifted to left. Playable for Conine, and the Marlins are going to the World Series.
His first at-bat of the game. There's a fly ball deep to left. It's on its way. There it goes. And the Yankees are going to the World Series.
And there is a week. The trial of D.C. sniper suspect John Allen Muhammad begins this week. A final jury of 12 was seated today. China launches a manned mission, the first Tychonaut, into Earth orbit. A summit of Anglican clerics ends in London with the warning that the upcoming November consecration as an American bishop of gay priest Gene Robinson will cause a schism in the church. The Staten Island Ferry in New York crashes into a pier, killing 10 people. Thousands of Catholics gather at the Vatican to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the papacy of John Paul II. Three Americans are killed in a roadside bombing in Gaza. A U.S.-sponsored U.N. resolution on Iraq is passed with a 15-0 vote by the Security Council. A suicide bomber explodes his truck near the Turkish embassy in Baghdad, killing himself and wounding a dozen others. The total number of U.S. combat deaths in Iraq since May 1st climbed to 101 today. Debate rages in Congress over the proposed $87 billion emergency spending bill for Iraq. Just hours ago, the House and Senate passed different versions of the bill. And the Florida Marlins and New York Yankees defeat the Chicago Cubs and Boston Red Sox for the National and American League pennants. The first game of the World Series is set for Saturday night. Big debate in Congress this week, Jack, about that big chunk of money to be headed off to Iraq and points elsewhere.
Yes, and a lot of information came out. I watched that debate carefully yesterday about the deployment in Iraq already. Effectively, how has the $60 billion we have already funded for the troops been spent and not spent? In the first place, we learned from the New York Times this week that over 100 large weapons dumps in Iraq are not being guarded or not being guarded sufficiently well to protect against incursion from terrorists who then take the bombs and weapons and use them against our troops. And the reason is we don't have enough troops there.
And this is the source of a lot of these explosives that are going off in ambushes, roadside bombings, and killing American troops.
That's right. And six rockets went into the cocoon in Baghdad, where Bremer and the Provisional Authority are this week, possibly taking from some of these dumps. We also learned that there are not enough jammers for the soldiers to use to prevent these roadside bombs from sending their fatal signal. Why they don't have the jammers, I don't know. There are not enough Kevlar blankets to protect their Humvees against these bombs. Why don't they have them? I don't know. 30 to 44,000 don't have proper flak jackets to protect them against the ammunition being used against them. There's apparently a plague of dysentery among the men because of the bad water they're being forced to use. No wonder a recent poll found that nearly half of all soldiers say they will not reenlist.
The Army generals themselves describing conditions there this week as reports from the Stars and Stripes, the military newspaper, came out on bad morale, saying, yes, the conditions are austere.
Austere indeed. And now, of course, we seem to be in the midst of an incipient Shiite civil war in Karbala. And, of course, the Shiites have been the one good sign thus far. They've greeted us with relative acceptance. And now one just doesn't know. It looks terrible there.
Well, still teetering there. The Army says it's determined to clamp down on the clerics who are pushing that militant line. But that's not easy to do. You clamp down and you get a kickback.
Yes, and apparently there was an ambush killing three military policemen yesterday, bringing to 11 the total killed this week.
It's a big number, and just a sorrowful drip that is hitting home closer and closer to more Americans. We're sorry to hear it. It makes everything back on the home front seem minor, but there was a lot of passion and attention this week poured into some baseball diamonds around this country, Jack.
Yes, and Chicagoans and Bostonians the world over have a lot to mourn, but a lot to look forward to. Two young teams, two very strong organizations. There's always next year.
There's always next year. We live in hope. Jack Beattie, have a great weekend. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.